Take a network break. Grab a Torah-shaped pastry in your favorite caffeine delivery system and join us for a jaunt through this week's tech news. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow, and we have a guest pundit today, Ed Horley, VP of Engineering at Groupware Technology. Before we get to the news, I want to thank our sponsors. This episode of Network Break is sponsored by Apstra and the Intent to Party Party. If you're going to Cisco Live this June, you can join Apstra and the Packet Pushers at a live event on Monday the 26th at the Border Grill for drinks, food, and great conversation. To request an invitation, surf over to go.apstra.com/event-packet-pushers-party, and we'll have that link in the show notes if you want to go find it. Today's show is also sponsored by Liquid Technology. They purchase decommissioned IT hardware, provide secure on- and off-site data destruction, and fully compliant and green e-waste recycling solutions for your organization. Visit liquidtechnology.net/podcast today for a chance to win a $300 Amazon gift card. That's liquidtechnology.net/podcast. To the news, if you remember back in 2013, the retailer Target was hit with a massive data breach. They lost millions of customer credit card records. 4 years on, the corporation has settled a lawsuit with 47 states and the District of Columbia for a paltry $18.5 million.
Not much, is it?
Not much at all. I saw that number and I was like, what?
$18.5 million, that's like, fair enough. That's the salary for what, $20 million? That's a salary for eight security professionals for 1 year. No, not eight, but yeah, like you get the idea, right?
Right.
Sort of that 80 IT professionals a year. 80, yeah. A staff of 80 IT professionals would cost you $20 million, give or take, right? By the time you put some managers and gave them computers and desks and things like that. You could easily assume that Target has now had to hire an extra 80. But in the meantime, they've not had to pay $20 million a year for those extra 80 security consultants. So I would imagine that Target's pretty happy about the whole thing. What do you think, Drew?
I was frankly aghast at the small size of the settlement. If you divide up that amount, $18 million or so, among 48 plaintiffs, they each walk away with just under $386,000, which I'm presuming they're distributing that money maybe back out to people who were hurt by this. I don't know, but it just seems like a surprisingly low amount of money.
Well, I think further down the article, it actually said Target claims the total breach cost, that whole breach that they had, cost them $202 million.
Right, which makes more sense, but this lawsuit, I don't know why they settled for that amount. Anyway, Ed, you have some comments too.
Well, I was just sort of curious who the actual list of plaintiffs was, because I guarantee you I'm probably not going to see a cent of it for my wife shopping at Target. So,
yeah, it's 47 states in the District of Columbia. I'm trying to guess how they're divvying it up, because California is getting the biggest chunk of this at $1.4 million. I presume it has to do with the number of citizens per state who were affected, perhaps. I don't really know how they divide it up, but...
Which, of course, means Target had to disclose everyone who actually was doing something there, which is just a whole different breach for the states to get hacked by, but whatever.
That'll be the next hack.
So this feeds into my long-term point about the cost of IT security exceeds the cost of what you're covering. So if you figure that $202 million and how much money Target saved by not having decent security in place, like $202 million, if you figure that out over 10 years, that's what, $20 million a year. Let's forget that money has value over time. That's basically 4 active audits. It's about, for a company the size of Target, to do an active audit, like you bring in the internal threat assessors and they run around and try and attack everything. That's going to cost you about $5 million a throw, right? So Target, by not spending that money, has actually trousered that money, probably saved itself way more than $200 million, probably up towards $1 billion over 10 years easily. I would think that it's just an absolute highlight that the cost of IT security, the cost of securing the risks inside of IT, outweighs the actual penalties that happen in the back. And that is why IT security is such a joke.
But I think the funny thing about this one was, right, the Target CEO actually took a pretty hard beating on this one. Yep. I think any shop that's prepared better is going to have the next person down the line who's going to take the fall for this as opposed to the CEO. But
again, if you're the CEO of a company and you're ignoring your IT security, then more fool you, because it's really now just a matter of time until you get breached. And that CEO was foolish not to pay attention to IT. And there's still plenty of CEOs not paying attention to IT at all. They just see it as like, accountants, go away. Just, you know, whatever. I don't even use a computer. I don't know, what is this desktop thing? Do you know what I mean? And the CEO of Target, I'll bet, probably hadn't even written a Word document, didn't even write his own emails. But the point remains is that think of how much money this company, this isn't the only company that's done it. Sure, there's some short-term pain here. But the long-term gain here is that Target's probably up more than $1 billion in general profits over a period of time by not bothering to implement decent security. So,
right. I just don't know if it was an intended outcome is sort of what I'm saying with the CEO statement, right? I don't know if it was a planned
thing. Never an intentional. So, you know, the cases that we see, they're not intentional because they're normally the companies who have been caught out and they handle it badly. my point is that the cost of IT security exceeds the cost of actually making it secure. So you might as well just not implement it and hope that you get away with it.
Right, just like Yahoo.
Yep, they almost got away with it. But they almost got away with it. Yeah, they almost did, yeah.
All right, moving on. Open19, that is an open source data center initiative. It was originally launched by LinkedIn. It's now become an official foundation. Open19's goal, quote, aims to create project-based open hardware and software solutions for the data center industry, and charter members include LinkedIn, HPE, GE, Vapor.io, and Flex. Ed, you were actually at this launch event and your company's a member. Do you have some insight here? What's going on with Open19?
Yeah. So Open19's, everyone always asks me, what's the difference between Open19 and an open compute project, and why in the world would anyone be interested in it? And it's pretty fascinating to actually talk to Yuval, who actually started this whole initiative because he actually came from Facebook and worked on OCP. So he's got a good perspective about why you would start Open19. But the reality is that Open19 is built for the rest of us, I guess is the easy way to say it. OCP is really built for the largest mega scale data center folks, the top seven or so that really can have, you know, onboard folks that are designing motherboards, folks that are designing, you know, electrical systems, heating and HVAC. And they're building what I call concrete up data centers. In other words, they're building facilities that they can modify how they actually deploy data centers for their new requirements. And that's really what OCP is designed for. Open19 is designed to fit in a 19-inch rack, which the rest of us all use. And does everyone actually know the history for 19-inch racks? Do you know where that actually comes from?
Oh, it comes from like a 1800 size of a something. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, for the railways, for the original railways, inside they built this standardized form factor for mounting equipment that carried forward into what we used for telco, for folks in other industries like entertainment audio industry, everything else, and then eventually computers. We have built and standardized our computer framework on 1800th century technology.
Right around the steam engine. Okay.
Railway signaling or something like that. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, here we are in the modern era. But Open19's goal is really just to say we standardize around a 19-inch form factor, make it so that it's modular. So everyone who's building around the same form factor, you can swap things in and out. So the power supplies are the same, et cetera, et cetera.
So it's not when we talk about, you know, the big seven data centers, they actually build data centers at data center scale. They don't think about one rack. They think about 80,000 servers in 1,000 racks or 5,000 racks or whatever it is, right? They think about building in an entire data center or refitting an entire data center at a time.
Yeah, they're thinking about, you know, how do I build at scale for 1 million square feet or whatever footprint they happen to have. And they don't care if an entire, you know, one quarter of the data center is burning at that given moment. You know, that's not their concern because they don't build in things like electrical isolation and a ton of other things that you would have to worry about, because at scale, they don't care if the adjoining rack catches on fire too, because they control all of it.
Yeah,
you care about that if you're in a hosted facility, right? You don't want your neighbor who happens to have their compute catch on fire for any given reason because they bought bad components lighting your stuff on fire too, right? That's not the goal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So if you're in an Equinix or a CoreSite or anything else, you have to have something that's actually conformed.
So would you think Open19 is better suited to building at rack scale, or does it work at sub-rack scale? So most companies today build at what I think of as sub-rack scale. The server here, a server there, a switch here, a switch there, a storage array here, a storage array there. And, you know, they fill up a rack at 410, 48, 16 IUs at a time.
Yep.
Is that the scale that Open19 is going to work at, or is it more like one rack, two rack, three rack?
So both. So what's really cool about Open19 and one of LinkedIn's requirements was they're like, you know what, we have locations, these microsite locations where we need 8U. So they have, these things are called brick cages. There's a brick is a 1U high half width. That's what it defines a brick. That's for a compute unit. And then, you know, the brick cages, the smallest today is 8RU. There's an 8 and a 12 brick cage. And you just stack the brick cages inside the whatever size rack you want and slide these modules in. The cool thing is, once you get the brick cage in, that's the only time you have to use tools. Everything else is toolless assembly. And that's the reason we're so interested in it, to be honest, is it really speeds up our time for delivery for our customers to be able to sort of pre-build things that way in Lego blocks.
So you can pre-build the bricks back at head office, then put them back in their boxes, ship them to slide, and then just slide them home into the cage.
Or better yet, we do rack level builds for our customers. Mm. So we deploy the entire rack and get rid of all that packaging material and integration. But the reality is that for us, you know, 2 to 3 days of cabling to install all of that. If I can do that in half a day, I can give that time back to the customer, right?
Well, that's a big thing that the Blade chassis was, all about back in the day. Except
yeah, but what sucked about
the blade vendors
chassis.
Tried to overdo the blade chassis and started to say, well, we have to add value to the chassis, and started to put fancy nicks. And
I don't even care about that part. It's that the problem is that the form factor isn't the same. So if you buy an Intel chip and you buy Samsung memory and you buy Samsung SSD and you buy it in the form factor from Cisco for UCS, and you say, you know what, I need to move this over to some other location. You pull that thing out, the exact same Intel thing you bought, the exact same Samsung memory, et cetera. You have to buy it again for Dell for the Dell chassis. You have to buy it again for the HP chassis. You have to buy it. You're buying the exact same thing over and over again just because the form factor isn't the same. And that's what Open19 solves. You don't care about that anymore. You just slide the thing in and fire it up.
So I know Open Compute started with servers, and it sounds like Open19 is also starting with servers. Open Compute also eventually switched over or incorporated switching. Do you think Open19 is going to have an impact on switching and networking as well?
Yeah, it already has a networking switch available. It's one of the things that's sort of cool about it. So it does have an open switch that is capable of running, you know, you can run Cumulus on it, you can run SnapRoute on it, you can run OVS, whatever open source brand you want to run. And that's already pre-built as out of the gate. Flextronics already has one available for people to start testing on. And I know Cumulus has already tested their software on it.
Okay.
I've spoken previously to people from LinkedIn about this Open19 standard. And they also talked about power connectors are actually connectors. You don't need to start putting power plugs into everything. You just have these connectors and you connect them up once and you're done for the whole chassis build. And the power connectors are sort of built for a 25-year time frame. They spent a lot of time designing that brick cage so that it minimizes the effort. You know, every time you change a server, you shouldn't actually have to change the power cable. That's just silly, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that idea of having a separate power bar attached to the metalwork, and that should all just be built into a standard board. And I think the actual board that controls the power itself is actually a modular thing as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, let's be honest here. You don't reestablish everything from the ground up. So, you know, they did the right thing. They borrowed from OCP where they needed to. So the BMS system is the same. So if you talk to Cole Crawford over from Vapor.io, you know, his open, you know, DCRE platform works just fine on Open19 from day one because it was using a lot of the same common components because those are all open source. This is the way it's going, is to have these open standards around hardware. I think the next revolution around this stuff is going to be the interesting stuff that LinkedIn does around their RFP call for the first time to use Open19. So they're going to issue an open RFP to bid on data center space effectively for their site location. It's going
to
be pretty interesting.
They need to build out a whole bunch of data centers to scale up LinkedIn now that it's been acquired by Microsoft. And
that's correct.
There are some hints, rumors that the technology that LinkedIn uses may fold into Azure as well. But
yeah, they're actively talking back and forth. Obviously, Microsoft's a huge OCP contributor, and Microsoft's building at that scale. But they wanted LinkedIn to continue investing the way they were because, you know, the first biggest customer for LinkedIn now is Microsoft, which is sort of funny. So the biggest data center LinkedIn has to build is to service Microsoft for Azure, for the integration with Office Team. So, you know, nothing like having yourself as your biggest customer.
Well, sticking with open source and foundations, the Container Networking Interface, that's an open source project for container networking, they have been officially blessed by the Linux Foundation as a hosted project alongside Kubernetes and other container-centric projects. And Greg, you were the one who called out the story because Cisco is actually playing a role here.
Yeah, this is the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, the CNCF. Its main role in life is to shepherd the Kubernetes. Google doesn't want it anymore and threw it over the fence to the Linux Foundation, and it's, you know, somehow maintained its popularity, but the CNCF then has to decide how it's going to get more adoption and more users. And we hear so much noise, and I call it noise because Kubernetes is being used by people around the place, but generally it's for play stuff. And Cisco's gone straight in there and said, we've got this amazing container networking interface, we should totally help you. They've created an open source project, and now they've committed to contributing a container networking interface to Kubernetes. Now, the reason why Cisco is doing this, in my opinion, is perfectly sound business strategy. They want to make sure that they're taking control of the network edge, which they've previously had to cede in the hypervisor. So both in KVM and ESX, they lost control of the network when VMware managed to get NSX into control. And then the Open vSwitch got into KVM hypervisors and most other brands of hypervisor. And so this positions Cisco back where it wants to be, controlling customers and making sure that they build a moat that customers can't leave and that they're actually back in control of where networking is going and what's actually happening there. That's how I see it anyway.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I know for a fact that Cisco is investing very heavily in Kubernetes overall right now. I know a bunch of projects that are going on internally at Cisco around that. But I find it fascinating that the sort of difference between this and Live Network for Docker, right? And the fact, you know, Containerd is also a project at the CNCF.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be some a little bit of battle that goes on there about how that's going to work out and what's going to be the final framework for. And obviously, it's going to be modular and plug-in. But yeah, I agree. This is Cisco's strategy for definitely entering that market and having some more direct impact about how networking is going to work in containers. Yeah.
And if you want to know what it looks like, go and look at Cisco's Contiv project. That's C-O-N-T-I-V. It's on GitHub, and that gives you a lot of insight. Cisco's actually done some really good work. This particular project has come out of a part of Cisco, which I'm very strongly positive about. They actually do pretty good work. They're doing things cleanly in the open. That is like on GitHub, not on a Cisco website hidden behind a login. The APIs are open. That is, you can go and get them from GitHub, and you can contribute to them. And so this is a very impressive effort. And I think the strategy behind this and the part of Cisco that this is coming from has a much better sense of how to do open than, say, the enterprise business unit. So this is very promising and probably good for everybody.
All right, sticking at Cisco, they and Microsoft have announced an IoT partnership. This is going to link Cisco's IoT edge compute offerings, which Cisco calls fog computing, with Microsoft's Azure IoT suite. The idea is that companies who are building IoT applications in Azure, they can link those applications with Cisco's edge computing services where data is collected from sensors and it can be processed and analyzed immediately for real-time applications, and then you can punt it up into Azure for storage and long-term compute and analytics.
So another one of these partnerships where Cisco wants to keep control. Cisco has a business unit inside the company. When you sell $50 billion a year of product, you're not one company, you're dozens of little companies. In there, one of them makes these little IoT edge devices. Cisco wants to make sure that people are buying their edge devices to go with that. And of course, to do that, they need to be using someone's central intelligence platform. So sure, Cisco's got Jasper as its strategic initiative going forward and would like people to buy Jasper and Cisco's Fog, which is just the edge stuff that Cisco makes. It's Fog's a pretty bad name for it, but there you go. Of course, if you're the Fog product manager, you want to sell more Fog. So you go out and partner with anybody who can stand still long enough. I expect we'll see an announcement with AWS's GreenLake or something probably within days as they attempt to partner with everybody and say, we work with everybody, you should totally buy all of our things because it's all great.
Yeah, I sort of question about how this is going to play out long term because Microsoft has got an edge solution put together. So I don't know how that's, and Amazon does too, right, with Greengrass.
Dell's got a hardware platform that they released 2 years ago in the IoT edge. HPE's got one. Intel's got one. Their developer conference last year, they talked about their whole hardware platforms that, you know.
Yeah, I sort of consider this like table stakes, like you had to have done this partnership or otherwise you weren't even a player at all, maybe.
Well, and you want to be partnered with everybody because you don't know who's going to win.
Yeah, that's the other one.
You don't know who's going to win. And when you're a big company, you certainly don't pick winners. You just do all of them because you need all the monies.
Right.
You don't select your customers. You want all the customers.
All right, well, let's take a quick break to talk about one of today's sponsors. This is Abstra and the Intent to Party, which they're holding with the Packet Pushers at Cisco Live. Greg, you can tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, Cisco Live. It's 6 to 8 weeks away. Can't wait for it. I'm going to be hanging around the social media lounge like a bad smell. And if you're going to be there, we would love to see you. But most importantly, we're going to be joining our friends at Abstra for dinner and some drinks and a great conversation at the Border Grill in the Mandalay Bay. The really cool thing about the Border Grill is it's right between where the convention center is and the main casino area where you go back to your hotel room in the Mandalay Bay. So it's really easy to get to. Great venue. It's an invitation-only event. So if you'd like to participate, you have to go and request an invitation and be approved to get on the guest list. It's not an open bar. Obviously, you want to make sure that you're getting people in there who you want to talk to. So Packet Pushers and Abstra have got together to have the Abstra Intent to Party. And we'd love to see you there at 7 o'clock on Monday, June 26th. That's Monday. That's the very first day of Cisco Live, which is not Sunday. Sunday's kind of like the pre-first day. No, I'm just joking. It's at the Border Grill in the Mandalay Bay Resort. Go over to go.abstra.com/event-packet-pushers-party. That's a bit of a mouthful. But there you go. Or come and head over to the Packet Pushers website. Check out the blog post that accompanies this podcast to get the link there and request an invitation. We'd love to see you at the Abstra party. We're going to have a little stage there. We're going to abuse everybody in the talk to everybody in the audience and make sure that you feel welcome. Have a couple of beers. And we would love to see you there.
Thanks, Abstra, for being a sponsor. And that's Monday, June 26th at Cisco Live. All right, back to the news, talking more about Microsoft. They have announced a $100 million acquisition of Hexadite. This is a security startup. I looked at the website. They capture alerts and alarms from security detection tools and then use automation to investigate every single alert, which sounds crazy to me, but it looks like the primary goal is to try to weed out false positives and surface up the real threats to human investigators. One thing that is interesting to note, that one of Hexadite's investors is actually Hewlett-Packard Ventures. That's an investment arm of HPE. So I'm wondering why HPE let this slip away.
I think this is another one of these, we have to have security in the cloud thing. So the ability to, when you have building security in the modern era, it's happening all over the public WAN all the time, right? And so what you want to be able to do is collect data from a wide range of edge points, send it back to a central point in the cloud, analyze it, and all of a sudden you have a whole internet or a whole public WAN sort of visibility as to what's going on. And that's what these companies are doing. And you've seen many of these companies have already been picked up by many people, like F5, Dyn DNS. Oracle bought Dyn because of the threat intelligence. When you own a DNS server, you're getting an awful lot of data collection from the DNS service. And Cisco bought a DNS provider recently, and so on and so on. They're all out there buying these cloud security providers who are aggregating up threat data, because they can now take that threat data that you gave them, analyze it, and then send it back to you and charge you money for it, which is always an interesting life cycle. So Microsoft's going to get into this space. I would guess that this is going to feed into their own security platform in an attempt to try and reduce the time cycle to making changes in their security tooling that they're giving, especially down in the SMB space. So you've got to reduce the time from identifying a threat, detecting a threat, researching it, and then deciding whether it's an active threat or whether it's something that can be weighted, and then push that data down to the customers as far as possible. So what you generally do is go out and buy a firm that's already been doing this for a few years, so you can rapidly ramp up that business as quickly as possible. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I see it complementary to their purchase of Adalom, which they picked up a little bit ago. And that one was much more sort of identity-based focused, and I see this as something that can sort of work lower down the stack in the IS side and do something similar in terms of that sort of, you know, intelligent sort of AI threat detection capability, but something that isn't necessarily identity-based.
And as far as HP Ventures, Hewlett-Packard Ventures, my guess would be is that they will have taken the money and put it back into their venture capital arm. Keep in mind that HP doesn't have a security portfolio that I'm aware of. If it does, I apologize, HP. But I'm not aware of any security like firewalls or threat intelligence engines or malware scanning or any of those sorts of tools. I believe that HP relies on partners for all of that sort of stuff. So they might be well happy to get rid of that and get a return on that investment and look for another thing to invest in that might be more in their core business line.
Our final Microsoft story for the day, the company has announced plans to offer Microsoft Cloud services, including Azure and Office 365, from data centers in Cape Town and Johannesburg, South Africa. Microsoft's hoping that companies across the continent will tap into these cloud resources, and the services are expected to be available next year. Ed, this is one that you brought to us.
Yeah, I found this really fascinating because they're the first of the major sort of four big cloud players to actually put something in Africa. It's in South Africa, but I find it sort of ironic or ironical. South Africa, that's sort of the birthplace for where AWS actually got to start. So the core team that built AWS all built it down when they were down in South Africa. Then Microsoft launches a data center down there. So that's sort of amusing in some ways.
Yeah, but it's very difficult for them to build data centers in Africa because of the political instability in many of these countries. But at the same time, many of the African countries, they need the latency of it being on land there. You don't want to be continually offshoring to somewhere in Europe for hosting, like AWS really only has Ireland so far, and they've got one coming in Germany, and the latency from especially the east coast of Africa to mainland Europe is actually pretty bad. So getting something on the ground in South Africa where the political environment is, well, modestly stable, shall we say, yes, and the power supplies are reasonably reliable is actually probably the only country that really could have taken this on at this particular point in time. So it's not unsurprising it's in South Africa.
Yeah. And then I think it sort of speaks to the sort of, I think now Microsoft has the largest number of regions deployed for any of the cloud providers. But I don't know how much that means versus square footage of data center capacity that you actually have. I think you have to evaluate everyone differently for that. I just thought it was sort of important just from an equalizer for both education and capabilities to provide services within the local economies for everything inside of Africa. I think it's sort of important that companies are starting to do this. So I thought it was sort of interesting news for that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, more news. SoftBank, they have partnered with Saudi Arabia and multiple tech companies to raise $93 billion that they're going to put into technology and startup investments. Other funders committing money to include Apple, Qualcomm, and an investment group from Abu Dhabi. And according to Bloomberg, this SoftBank fund aims to raise $100 billion by this fall.
So this is a big financial news. SoftBank's made a number of very, very large acquisitions over the last 5 or 10 years. Miyoshi-san, who's the CEO and founder of the company, has made some super big investments in companies and actually made really significant wins. And really, this is a vote for these companies to say, this guy really knows how to buy companies and turn them around and double down in the side of a very short period of time in tech investment. And so this is actually a step. One of the interesting parts about this story, and I don't know if it's any of the articles that we talked about, is that apparently Saudi Arabia said that they would put their money into the fund, but only if it was going to benefit Saudi Arabia directly. In other words, they wanted to make sure the fund was actually investing in putting these companies into Saudi Arabia as they'd look for a post-oil future.
Interesting.
Now, when was the last time you heard that being mentioned?
I think it's smart for, you know, the Gulf states to be thinking about a post-oil future, and technology investment is certainly one way to go. I know they're also making a push into financial services and other sort of things that are adjacent to the oil economy. But yeah, why not? They've got the money. They might as well start building.
I think Saudi's looking at Abu Dhabi and what they've done in terms of transition away from oil, right?
Well, Norway in particular. Yeah, Norway has done that. They've taken all of their oil revenue and invested into a national fund. So it's all owned by the government. And then that national fund is then invested on behalf of all the citizens of Norway. And it now makes so much money that they can actually pay everybody in Norway like a salary just because of the oil revenue that's built up over 30 years. So, yeah, it's funny. It's very interesting if you want to go and read about that and find out what's exactly happening. But that's what sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing that Saudi Arabia is trying to do. They realize that the oil revenue is probably reaching its final phases, and they're sort of saying, well, what do we do post oils? Well, technology is a good thing that we could potentially do. Let's start kicking off an industry, as are many governments. Many governments are spending significantly large sums to build technology incubators in their countries and trying to attract technology people and to attract investors to try and drive technology startups in their local economy as a way of getting away from manufacturing and other toxic industries as well.
Yeah, time to diversify.
But you look at this and you look at this is almost $100 billion of investment, right? I mean, this can change the entire market. I mean, they're one decision by these folks, right? SoftBank says, we want to throw our money at this company. And you got this amount of money besides being able to buy out like something like the top 10 companies anyway. But $100 billion. I mean, I just want to be the guy that rolls in and says like, yeah, I've got $100 billion to invest. Like, you know,
who wants to take me to dinner?
I mean, SoftBank has made some amazing. I'm trying to find an article that lists out some of the really the most surprising companies that they've bought, but they've bought some amazing.
Well, the most recent, I think, was Arm Holdings.
Yes, exactly. Right. They bought Arm. That's the one I was trying to think of. The whole Arm ecosystem is now owned by SoftBank. And it was like a $30 billion purchase. Is that right? It was multiple tens of billions of dollars of purchase. And it really shook the foundations of the whole game when that happened. And that's basically what SoftBank is talking about doing here. $90 billion. They're not going to go around building a couple of hicky startups with young kids who are willing to live in bunk rooms for 2 years. They're going to go and buy big, fat, mature technology businesses and jam them together to make something bigger or better, or fracture them into pieces and try and pick the value out of it. This is a $10 billion a time game, not a piecemeal venture capital investment like it's being done in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I mean, what's amazing is how do you get Apple and Qualcomm?
And this arm investment? I saw that and I was like, wow.
All the funding together, it's like, wait, okay, we got cats and dogs. Like, you know, what's going on here? That's a little strange. And I agree with you. I mean, this also shows the power of the rising sort of power of investment arm of Asia and the Middle East now. I mean, it really does change. I mean, Silicon Valley looks interesting. You know, I'm born and raised in Silicon Valley, so, you know, far be it for me to like kick it in the teeth because I made my living here. But it's no longer the U.S. making investments overseas about how things work. It is reversed completely now. Silicon Valley is going to get bought out. That's effectively what's going on.
Yeah. So it has to be said, $93 billion could go a fairly substantial way to buying out most of Silicon Valley. A substantial part of it, at least, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. It's astounding. I can't believe that much money is being put together to do that, but whatever.
Yeah. I guess. But also given to somebody who really knows how to make that work.
Yeah. That's what's really sort of surprising. I guess I need to learn a foreign language because I'm not going to be speaking English much more soon. Much longer here. I'm not going to stay in Silicon Valley, but whatever.
Can you say konnichiwa?
No kidding.
All right, moving on. Cray, they're experimenting with a cloud model by offering the use of their Eureka GX supercomputer as a service. It looks like they're targeting life science customers, according to a story in the Top 500. And Ed, this is a story you brought to us.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe Cray was in the news about cloud.
It is.
But, you know, I mean, with AI and with everything happening, machine learning and deep learning and everything else, and that's really where the pedigree for Cray comes from. I guess I'm not surprised from that standpoint, but it just supercomputing as a service. I guess we're back to supercomputing days and seeing that's on the rise again.
Was a time when we used to have mainframe bureaus. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
There was a bureau and you would send your data in by tapes, and the tapes would be put into a special box and carried off, and then they'd load the tapes in, and then the mainframe bureau would run your job for you, and then the tapes would be sent back to you to load into your own mainframe. There was a time like that where it was actually normal. Amazon sort of revisited that really with its container of data, you know, those snowballs where you send your tapes off to AWS and you do the data processing and they send it back. It's funny how nothing ever changes in technology, really. But this Cray is actually being hosted by a company in Boston who are obviously done a deal with Cray to rent one or buy one and deploy it in some data center facility in the hope that people will come along and need a Cray to do some sort of analysis. But I'm always a bit dubious about these sort of things because data has mass. Like data, just moving data around where you get to the Cray means that you need either really, really fast links or some way of transferring the data in and out, whether it's a truckload of tapes or CDs, you know, whatever it is. And so I'm not 100% sure how this actually works. Life sciences uses vast data to do the analysis. You need to be able to have DNA results and stuff like that. So getting the data in and out of the system might actually be a bit of it, or storing it permanently is actually the harder part about this than actually the Cray itself. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that, maybe follow it up.
Yeah. I think the other thing that you have to remember is often for many of these supercomputer services, getting the data out isn't so painful because you just have some sort of, you know, metadata set that you're pulling down afterwards. So you're not actually retaining a long history of data. But I imagine that getting data into the system is going to be pretty painful unless they're trying to tie it in with a streaming service of some type where you're doing analysis. But life sciences normally doesn't work that way. So I agree, it's going to be a little painful to get data in there.
All right, just a quick break to talk about our other sponsor today, Liquid Technology. Do you have decommissioned IT equipment just sitting in your data center or office? Is your company planning an upgrade, a cloud migration, or relocation? This is where Liquid Technology can help. They'll de-rack, pack, and purchase your excess technology hardware. You can increase your budget by getting money back for your excess IT equipment. Liquid Technology will ensure your end-of-life IT equipment is safe. They provide on- or off-site auditable data destruction services. So whether your operations are in Tulsa or Tokyo, Liquid Technology has expert knowledge and local regulations to deliver a compliant global solution to your company. And Liquid Technology is an EPA-recognized dual-certified green recycler. So don't let your assets depreciate in powered down racks or storage rooms. Get all that space back and maximize the return of your excess technology. Visit liquidtechnology.net/podcast today for a chance to win a $300 Amazon gift card. That's liquidtechnology.net/podcast. And thanks, Liquid Technology, for being a sponsor. Okay, just a couple of stories to wrap up this episode. Last week, we had talked about a patent settlement between Apple and Nokia. And as part of that settlement, Apple pledged to buy some Nokia products. And Greg, you and I kind of scratched our heads about that. But then someone reached out to you, Greg, and had a few more details.
Yeah, so we talked about this. And I think we actually talked about this in a previous show where Withings was actually pulled out of the store because Apple went, yeah, you're doing me, I'm taking my toys and going home. And of course, the reason that Apple is now putting all of Nokia's toys back in the store is because they've ceased the litigation, which is actually sort of a, like, a, I'll stop hitting you with the bat if you stop calling me names type of thing, right? So that's what it means, is that Nokia can now put its Withings after they bought that, which is one of these companies that does health stuff like blood pressure cuffs and intelligence scales. So now they're back in the store. Yay them. Thanks for Charlie for tweeting that at me and highlighting the point. Always good to get things corrected and made right. And if you've got any feedback you want to give us about the show, please email it in, packetpushers@gmail.com, or hit us up on the Twitters. And if you think I've gone off the deep end, or if you think I've said something wrong, or Drew's got something particularly right and you want to congratulate him on being right all the time, because he usually is, why don't you tell us?
Yeah, that's fine. No, I get things wrong too. Okay, last story for the day. This is about the Supreme Court. Apparently, they are limiting patent venue statutes.
Now, this is a big deal. So this is a Supreme Court ruling in the U.S. So there's nowhere else it can go. It can't be rescinded. It can't be changed. And the Supreme Court has decided to limit the patent venue statute, which is previously there was court cases which said you could make your patent claim in any court in the country that suited you. And then whoever you were suing over the patent violation would then have to come to you. And so eventually the law firms, or the trolls, as we usually call them, found that East Texas was the friendliest court for doing patent litigation. And now there's entire office blocks full of lawyers just suing patent litigation in Eastern Texas. Now, if you happen to be somebody like Cisco, who actually is head office in Silicon Valley in California, having to traipse all the way out to East Texas is actually quite a painful thing. And if you're the law troll, that's a good thing for you, right? because you don't actually have to leave the state and travel, a fly across town to attend the court problems. So this is great. So from now on, if you're going to sue a company, you have to sue them in their own, in the head office jurisdiction in which they're legally registered in the US. So now if you're a law trial and you want to sue Cisco, you now have to do it in California. That radically changes the cost basis on which patent suits or troll-like, speculative lawsuits can be done, because now they have to be held in the court where the company's head office. They have to travel to lodge documents, to make submissions, and then they have to attend court in those areas. So this should change and may reduce a lot of the frivolous lawsuits and protect consumers. Quite often people are being sued by these law firms, sending out patent demands saying, oh, I see you're using my video player. Pay me $1,000 and I won't sue you. And they can do that from wherever they happen to be. And now they have to sue the person in their local state, in their local jurisdiction. And that should really change it for both companies, but also for people, individuals being sued, and particularly small companies being sued. So that's a great thing. And long overdue, I think. I think this process has been wending its way through the courts for about a decade. So yay to the legal system for hurrying things up.
I think I got one right.
Is this head office location, or is this actually where you're registered as a company? Because otherwise it just moves to Delaware.
Yes, well, even that would be. So it says the venue was construed broadly to be essentially anywhere a defendant has minimum contacts. By today's decision, venue is construed narrowly as limited to where the defender is either incorporated or two, has a regular and established pace of business in which the defendant committed acts of infringement.
Okay, so it's right. So it's your home location or Delaware.
It's going to be right. Two locations. But Delaware is not a patent friendly as East Texas.
Sure.
So that's the big change. And then you could always go to the court and say, we would actually rather have this in incorporated jurisdiction. And not too many companies actually do regular established business in Delaware. I would imagine they would actually shut up their offices in Delaware and leave right about now.
They just have a post office box. Yeah. Well, it's nice to see what seems like a good change to the patent law, because our patent system is a little screwy here in the United States. So this seems like a good step. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you if they want it?
Well, people can find me on my blog at etheriumwine.com. I'm still ejecting little molecules of thought as microblogs these days there. On the Twitter is at etheriumwine, where my inspired and enlightened cynicism tends to shine right through my erudition. And also, I will be continuing to contribute to the Human Infrastructure magazine over on the Packet Pushers website. You should totally get over there and subscribe.
Ed, you're also a social. Where can folks find you and follow you?
Probably easiest is on Twitter. So at ehorley. So it's ehorley. That's the fastest, quickest. Otherwise, you can hit my blog, which is howfunky.com. You can get my musings for anything I'm working on.
All right. And I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, Apstra and Liquid Technology. And Ed, thank you for joining us today. And thanks to all our listeners for tuning into this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, give us a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. And please do check out our newsletters. That's Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those at packetpushers.net. And as always, thanks for listening.